Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Every week we try to live up to his high standards of hosting a discussion of current events laced with empathy, intelligence, we hope a little humor, and progressive persuasion. Although Brian's concept was less is more, more or less, in reality, you could never have enough of Brian's magic in your life. Today, Truman O'Brien is guiding us from the Voice of Vachon Gene Bosch studio in bustling, bodacious downtown Vachon, and joining Truman as his wingman is Craig Bellis. Zooming in from home is Kevin Jones, and I'm Bruce Hallman, zooming in from my Vachon home. And joining us today, it looks like from home or his office, I can't tell for sure, is Emilio Taltike with Byrne Design Lab to talk about the work Byrne is doing. Welcome, Emilio.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And yes, from the office.
Oh, from the office. One real working person in the group. So before we get to Emilio and Byrne Design, let's talk about Vachon and the broader world. What's been going on in your world this week, Kevin?
This is like the transition from summer to winter for me at this point. Oh, is my audio coming through okay?
Yeah.
It's fine.
Oh, looks like I'm fading in and out. Hopefully this is better now. Okay. Yeah, we're kind of in the transition from summer to winter. I've disconnected all of the irrigation, the drip irrigation, since we now fortunately have Mother Nature watering the plants and the forest. But yeah, we're sort of getting ready for the shift in the weather.
Good. Craig, how about you?
Oh, I had a little medical procedure last week. I had a pound of flesh taken out of my arm.
Boy, it looks like it too.
But I feel good. Just a few dozen stitches. But I had fun last night. I was down here at the studio where we're sitting right now and handing out candy and looking at all the fabulous costumes. Halloween on Vachon is truly a unique experience, and the weather held out for us. Which, by the way, I looked at the weather report, and they said it was, mixed snow and rain a week from tomorrow here on Vachon. So we kind of went from summer to winter, like bam.
Yeah. Yeah, really quickly. Yep. Yeah. How about you, Emilio? What's up with your world?
Yeah, no, this is my first going into, I guess like you said, joke now, winter on Vachon. So just getting ready for that. But a lot of business as usual for us here at Byrne. So,
and how about, let's see, that's everybody except me.
You know? No, you left me out.
Truman, I left Truman out.
Truman. How could you forget?
You're hidden by the microphone.
That's... Oh, yeah, I know. I'm hiding back here.
It's hard to hide behind that microphone.
It is. That's
right. He overlaps the edges. Right?
Yeah, there you go. Oh, I don't know. It's been pretty quiet. I really enjoyed, I did not get out last night because, my walking ability is not quite at 100% yet, and I didn't want to push it. But, boy, it was sure fun looking at all the videos and photographs of folks. Vachon is such a unique place. I love it when they shut down the main street and all of the businesses are open and all the kids and the adults are all in their costumes. It's just really fun, and I really appreciate the chamber coordinating that. And Kevin, you were going to say something?
Well, all this talk about costumes. Yeah, all this talk about costumes. I have to say that the costume party, Get Out the Vote costume party, was great fun. We did the triangle route. We talked to a number of voters on the boats. And, people have got their ballots. they're working to get their ballots in. Talked to a couple that said, all of our stuff is on the dining room table. We're going home tonight. We're going to read it all and fill out our ballots. Tuesday next week, next Tuesday, by the time you're listening to the Brown Briefly, you're going to want to have your ballot filled out and make plans to get it into the Dropbox.
Yeah, Craig.
One other minor point. Thank you very much for that, Kevin. The lip sync final competition was this last week, and I was honored to be one of the judges in that final group. And Truman was there running running the board, yeah, engineering, that was great fun. And we wanted to thank everybody who contributed and voted for the various individuals in that lip sync competition. There was lots of fun videos. So thank you all.
And I'll throw in my two cents. It's one of our major fall fundraisers, and we actually did meet our goal, our fundraising goal. So a huge thank you to the Vashon community for supporting the Voice of Vashon, in particular our emergency alert service on 1650. That's a huge thing. So anyway, yeah, thanks to everyone for that.
Sure. Yeah, and Vashon steps up where the nonprofits on the island are concerned.
You bet.
That's one of the very, very sort of good things about living on Vashon. There's a lot of support for things like Voice of Vashon and the museum and the Nature Center and the Land Trust, and the list goes on. But there's a large number of organizations that depend on public donations, and we all appreciate them. So thanks for that, Truman. So my world has been pretty calm. I'm fighting a head cold, which I haven't had a cold for 3 years, and then all of a sudden, wham, you know, I've been testing every day, so it's not COVID, but it's just a plain old nasty head cold. So it's sort of a reminder that the season is changing. But it's also been interesting watching KVI Beach and how the beach has changed just in the last 2 weeks in terms of the types of birds, the amount of activity. I mean, it's really dramatic shift from summer to what's nearly winter. As Craig pointed out, next week, snow on the forecast. So we'll see. But today, like all days, is significant. Yesterday, of course, was All Hallows Eve, Halloween, which means today is All Hallows Day or All Saints Day. And tomorrow, interestingly enough, is National Deviled Eggs Day. So I don't know if it's just the Halloween folks trying to keep things going for a couple days or what, but it's also today is National Authors Day.
Oh,
day to celebrate writers and the books they write. So how about your favorite author, Truman? Who's your favorite author?
Well, you know, this is I'm embarrassed to say that I was getting off the airplane years ago, and someone said, oh, this person left the book, and we have no idea who it was or where it was. Well, it turned out to be Dan Brown, of course, and the, going blank here, Da Vinci Code. So I was totally hooked on that. And of course, then I during that same period, I ran into a fellow who said, oh my gosh, I'm just reading the best book I've ever written. And I said, so how is Lonesome Dove? And that was what he was reading. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So anyway, those are two guys I really like.
Emilio, how about you? Favorite author?
Yeah, I had a tough time thinking of one, but I think right now I'd have to go with Anthony Mara. I read A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, which I think was his first book a while back. And he was kind of the first author where I started looking up, okay, when's the next book coming out? Because they've all just been so good.
Oh, great. And Craig, how about you?
Oh, my. I can't limit myself to one. I have to tell the quick story of my mother and her doctor. She had a doctor. My mom lived to be 93. God rest her soul. And she told me I was taking her to the doctor's office in Mountain View, California, and she commented to me. She said, you know, my doctor's kind of, you know, he's a very nice man, and he has a book that he wrote, and he's probably going to want to talk to you about it. So be nice to him, you know, be polite and everything. And So I went in there, and initially I'm in there with her, and I mentioned to the doctor, I said, doctor, I understand you've you've written a book. And he goes, yeah, I have. And I said, well, how's it doing? And he goes, well, it's pretty good. And I go, oh, what do you mean? And he goes, well, it's number one on Amazon. And I go, well, what's the name of it? Well, he said, it's called The Kite Runner. Hosseini was my mother's doctor before he quit the practice and went on tour. Certainly, he's one of my favorite. On a lighter note, Carl Hiaasen, the author from Florida who does those adult funny mysteries, murder mysteries down there. I get a kick out of those. He's probably written 30 at least of those. So,
and we have to plug our own
Michael Witt.
Michael Witt, right here on Vashon.
Yeah, Vashon Fall.
Yep.
Number one in disaster books on Amazon.
Kevin, how about you? Are you with us, Kevin?
Kevin said it was.
I'm with you. Hopefully, am I.
My
video's off, but my audio should be coming through.
Yeah, loud and clear.
Okay, very good. So I'm in a similar situation with Craig. You know, I'm married to a librarian, so that's just one of the things that comes along with that pleasure is a lot of opportunity to read books. I have 2 posthumous awards. One is Robert L. Wood for his tremendous books about early exploration on the Olympic Peninsula. And Winston Churchill, he made a living out of writing, amongst other things, and both highly, highly regarded, pretty amazing. But those who are among the living, it's a tie between Jeff Shara, whose tremendous history books about the Civil War, and John Krakauer, who just will tell an amazing story. Almost anything you pick up from Krakauer is awesome. But Into Thin Air and Apologies for Those Who espouse the Mormon religion, Under the Banner of Heaven, both tremendously moving books by that author.
I could not agree more. Both of them were just, the Under the Banner of Heaven was absolutely terrifying in my mind. Whew. Yeah.
Well, do we need to read the disclaimer again?
yeah. No, it's okay. We can have
Brian
our own
opinion.
Brian
already did that. We're safe. Brian already did that. You know, my favorite author is well, of course, I've got lots and lots like everybody does, but David McCullough is just, you know, the consummate sort of storyteller historian, you know, and just have loved all of his books. Very readable and also very insightful sort of. So it's a world of books that we need to celebrate today. So go out and buy a book by your favorite author, you know, help them keep their careers going. Today is also the day, November 1st, 1765, when the British Parliament passed the Stamp Act, infamous Stamp Act. So perhaps there's lessons in that for all the state legislatures that we see passing restrictive legislation right now. Craig, any insights onto the Stamp Act?
Oh, my goodness. No. You didn't give me a warning on that one.
Oh, sorry.
Just watch your P's and Q's and be careful what you're enacting. We got enough problems.
Exactly. Legislative overreach.
Yep.
This is also the day in 1952 that the first thermonuclear bomb exploded, the H-bomb. And it's also in 1993 when the European Union, the Treaty of Metternich, became a reality. So, you know, we are in a famous day today. But we're really here to talk to Emilio, who is a mechanical engineer with Byrne Design Labs. So for those of you that don't know about Byrne Design, they're tucked into a corner of the Sheffield building. They're founded on a vision to design the world's best cook stoves, and their expertise in design and prototyping testing, they led to development of an N95 mask decontamination system in response to the COVID pandemic. So, Emilio, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, about what you do with Byrne Design, and what brought you to that role at Byrne and on Vashon?
Yeah. So I graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering. And then after graduating, I was fortunate to do a year of service And I was jealous because I met a lot of people that went on to do work in social work, teachers, you know, kind of a lot more kind of what you would say call meaningful work. And unfortunately, with engineering, a lot of my opportunities were to build weapons or dig oil. And I was like, well, where can I do humanitarian work? So I went on a bit of a venture, and on this website, Engineering for Change, I read about the opportunity, applied for the job, and that brought me out here because this is Burn Design Lab might be one of the few kind of nonprofit engineering organizations out there. So very appreciative for what we get to do here.
Oh, great. So where did you come from? What's your background? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, born in kind of Southern California. Then we moved out to Texas. And so I went to school out there at Texas A&M, and a very, very good school. And I chose it for the engineering program.
Go Aggies. Go Aggies.
Yeah, go Aggies. Yeah, I never knew what kind of reach it had. So I guess, especially for college football fans have probably heard of this. But.
You're talking to a Texan here.
I'm a former.
Oh, really?
University of Texas.
Go okay, Horns. Yeah. My high school every year was kind of split between UT and A&M, and at the time, just more people were going to A&M, and I didn't want to pay rent in Austin. You went back in the day, but nowadays, so good.
Yeah. Now, when I started at University of Texas, this dates me. There were 20,000 students. Oh, when I left, 5 years later, there were 50,000 students.
The
baby boom arrived.
it's a great school too. Austin's pretty great. So
tell us a little bit about the history and background of Burn Design and why Vashon.
So some of your listeners might remember, so Burn Design Lab was founded by Peter Scott back in 2010 with the goal of developing the world's best clean cook stove. I wasn't around back then. Actually, it's funny. That's when I was like starting high school. So kind of crazy from the very 2010. But I heard he was really a charismatic guy, got a lot of people on the island pretty involved. And it was founded as a nonprofit. But in less than a year, they realized that actually the best way to develop, manufacture, and get clean cook stoves to the consumer was to start a for-profit manufacturing facility in Kenya. So he moved out there, his family moved out there, and they started a separate for-profit organization called Burn Manufacturing. And so they've been going for a few years now. And so to kind of sum up, they're kind of a split from Burn Design Lab. So we want to make that distinction because a lot of people kind of remember that history, but yeah, we just want to point out that we're different now. So it is a little confusing because we share the same names a little bit, Burn Design Lab, Burn Manufacturing. Burn Design Lab, we're still a growing and vibrant nonprofit here on Vashon. And as far as what we're trying to accomplish, Burn Manufacturing kind of pinpoints 30 to 50 US dollar stoves, and they design and manufacture stoves under their own kind of namesake, their own brand. At Burn Design Lab, we try to partner with local organizations in Africa, and NGOs out there to improve their own stove designs and manufacturing facilities. So we don't make anything under our own name, but we kind of provide engineering and testing services to those organizations. And we tend to target stoves more in the $4 to $10 price range. Mm-hmm.
So I have a quick question. So do you support manufacturers in other places besides Kenya? I mean, are there other countries that...
Yeah. So right now we did one in, I was brought on for a project in Uganda. They were making about 5,000 stoves a month, and they came to us and they said, we'd love to get to 15,000. We just don't know how. And so, we came in, we took a couple visits to their facility, and through time, we kind of recommended machinery they can buy, trainings on modern manufacturing. And, currently in Ghana, we're setting up a stove there, and we're doing the same. We're building up a local manufacturing facility.
So, you know, I was in Kenya back in 2008, and I was astounded with the number of little businesses that, you know, I mean, the cell phone is what allowed that to happen.
Oh, yeah.
The bicycle repair, yep. You know, any kind of manufacturing thing out of nothing. I mean, it's amazing what these folks do.
Yeah, very entrepreneurial. Yeah. Absolutely. It makes it interesting because you'll just be driving around the city and you know, there's not really big signs or anything, so you kind of have to just start talking to people, and next thing you know, you find a little stove factory in someone's house in their, you know, backyard, essentially.
Right.
Yeah, and the use of cell phones also very prominent. I see another question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Craig.
Yeah, I don't know if you can do this on the radio, but maybe you can. You can try. From an engineering standpoint, why are your stoves environmentally better than a wood fire?
Right. The best way I can describe it is just has to do with the combustion process and. Fuel efficiency. So when you cook on an open campfire, like let's say you're starting a campfire, just some wood on the ground, you get a lot of smoke. And when you're burning that kind of environment, I'm going to loosely use the phrase kind of incomplete combustion. So you get a lot of smoke and you get worse emissions. But when you cook in a more enclosed environment and you have more insulation, you get more heat going straight to the pot is one thing. So they use less fuel for the same amount of cooking, so you don't have to cut down as many trees. And the other part is you actually get a burning process of the fuel where there's less harmful emissions emitted. So those are kind of the two key environmental benefits.
Without giving a plug for another company, there is, of course, Solo stoves, which cost considerably more money than the stoves you're talking about. Do they use some of the same kind of concepts, engineering do you know?
Yeah, a lot of cook stoves are pretty, a lot of a similar idea where you just have a isolated kind of combustion chamber, some kind of insulation. And so if you just use more expensive materials, metal, maybe a vacuum chamber, things like that, I'm not sure how the Solo stove works, but you just get a better efficiency. Whereas what we're targeting is, like I said, to get the cost down to $4. It's the same concept, combustion chamber, things like that. But you're just using less expensive materials, typically a ceramic.
And while I've got the floor, how significant an issue are open wood fires in some of these countries?
Yeah, I mean, so worldwide, half the world still cooks what we're calling an unimproved cook stove or an open fire. And it's crazy to think about. What I try to tell people is, imagine if every time you wanted to heat up water or cook, you had to start up a campfire. And that's kind of what half the world still experiences. But it is only in certain areas, so Africa being one, Central America, and I think parts of India. So a lot of work has been done. But yeah, still a lot of the world, that's their daily life.
So just to follow up on that then, do you folks, I know you have several operations in Africa, are you doing things in Central and South America as well?
Right now, not as much. I think early on we had some projects there, but I think from what I've learned, just the populations are bigger in Africa. I think there's just been more grant money going there to help us develop these facilities. So that's kind of why we've moved more towards just Africa for now.
And one more question about it, the engineering. So are you folks continually trying to refine the process of the stove? I mean, is that one of the things that you guys do?
Yeah, luckily, for the most part, the design of stoves has become pretty kind of like a universal concept. Everyone kind of knows what makes, as far as there's variations of how far you want the pot being from the stove, combustion chamber ratio sizes, a lot of that stuff. Really, the challenges are how do you manufacture it locally? Because maybe this thickness of sheet metal isn't available. Maybe rivets aren't available. So that's the engineering challenge and what we go to, because as an example, we have a project in Uganda. There's a certain supply chain. They can build the stove a certain way. What machinery is available? A few countries over in Mozambique, you know, we want to build a similar stove, but we have no idea what the supply chain is. So maybe we have to modify the design to make it possible to build there, because to make them in another country and ship them in has just been proven to not work. So,
Kevin.
So, you know, along this line of Burns' expansion and your global reach with your technology, do you have companies, countries coming to you? Is that primarily how you get connected, or is there an outreach program? How are you building awareness and being able to expand the application of your technology into all these parts of the world?
Yeah, I would say we have a couple different ways. One is we go to conferences a lot. So an organization was founded a while back called the Clean Cooking Alliance. And so they do a good job of putting on these conferences. And so we'll attend and kind of spread what our organization does. So that's one way we kind of get outreach. Sometimes organizations do come to us. So the UNDP in Mozambique, I heard they just came across our website, sent us an email one day and said, we want to develop a stove for this market in our country. Can you help us design one? And so sometimes people reach out to us. And the third way in Ghana, you know, we kind of just made that project happen. I think we were given a research grant a while back to visit their shave roasting process. And we've really kind of built that project ourselves, talking to different companies that make shea butter and telling them, hey, we can help you help the people that make your shea butter have a better quality of life by reducing smoke, improving fuel efficiency. So kind of in those three different ways of people finding out about us and also us reaching out to people. Same for the factory in Uganda. You know, they were their own organization. They had their own facility. And they, like I said, came to us and said, you know, we need help getting from 5,000 to 15,000. Can you help us get there?
I have a question on financing. I understand that you're a nonprofit, and does most of your funding come from grants, or is it from donations? And is there any money return for your work in Africa? I mean, does any money come back from that particular effort?
Right. Yes. Well, so I'll give a quick note here. Apologies to our grant writer. She knows more of the financing side. I'm going to give my best from what I remember in different things I've seen. I'm going to go on a limb. I say we mostly run on independent donations from people. Our executive director, Paul Means, and at the time, Peter Scott as well, did a good job of getting people here in the Seattle area, people that they know, to donate. So we run off a lot of that. And then we also do apply for grants and get grants at times. I know that's a part of it. I don't think it's the majority. I may be wrong on that. And then the last part, yes, is we really try to get funded projects. So, for example, this the project in Lira, Uganda, you know, they came to us and they said, hey, we need help to get from 5 to 15,000. And we said, okay. And so we've put in portions of our own money by, let's say, providing my salary, but we try to help them make it a part of the deal where they say, okay, if we're going to go out there, can you pay for our time and expenses to visit? They pay for the equipment that they're installing. And then together, sometimes we'll tell them, hey, we heard about this grant that could apply to your factory. Let's help you write the grant and let's raise the money together. So we were able to do that. And then at times, like our project, hopefully in Mozambique, they come to us and they say, we want to do it. We have the money for it. And then they'll pay for all the costs of the equipment, the travel, and at times, you know, material and portions of our salary. So we kind of, it's a balance of all those things.
Interesting. You're muted, Bruce.
Oh, yeah.
How specific is the design to the fuel source? I mean, you've got lots of different potential fuel sources. Do you modify the design based on fuel sources, or how does that work?
Yeah, there are two main, it's really wood or charcoal. And with so those are two different stoves for sure. There's a couple stoves where they've attempted to make it. You can use wood or charcoal. Those are obviously less fuel efficient. So that's one. And then from there, you know, all charcoal over there is actually, most of it is actually made from wood. It's a process where they bury it underground. And people use charcoal just because it's more convenient way to cook. The charcoal is pretty standard. So if you make one charcoal stove, it's likely that it'll work in kind of any country in any area. All the charcoal tends to come in roughly the same size. We try to build habits on how much to fill the stove, you know, how to light it, things like that. But for the most part, pretty universal. Same thing with the firewood, tends to be pretty universal. We try to teach things like how much to feed it and things like that. But what will vary the stove size really is the pot size. That's what we have to kind of customize. Is an example being we're trying to get into Ghana and Western Africa, and they actually use pots with a round bottom. Most stoves are designed for a flat bottom. So that's an area where we have to work on customizing. But the fuel tends to be pretty universal.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, Truman.
Yeah, I have two questions. One is, is this are your designs a open design, or do you hold a patent on them, or how does that work?
Yeah, that is a good question. I would have to dig in a little bit. So for our Shea roaster, that's something that we develop on our own, but we're developing it in partnership with another organization. So I can't give any certainties, but that one I would say probably is more private. For the example, for the one in Uganda, they own the design. And while we helped them modify it, we agreed that, you know, that's their design and we're not going to kind of take any ideas from it. I can't give any certainties on that. But like I said, most stoves are pretty, I can do some visual for you guys, but for the radio, it's kind of hard to explain, but you can just imagine a little ceramic chamber for holding charcoal and then a metal jacket and some kind of dirt packing insulation. It's just a matter of how it goes together. But, when you go talking about it being entrepreneurial, if you go to a town, you'll see someone selling all different stoves, and because people just kind of see it, know how to copy it and make another one. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty accessible to make your own on a small scale, though the problem is then scaling to something of a larger volume.
And then the second part of my question is, I would expect that from an engineering standpoint, you would have an interesting job, because everyone's going to be different, I would think, and each application is going to be different. And your job, I would assume, is to customize that application for that particular use. Is that correct?
Yes. That's where we really push on this concept called human-centered design. And early on, it seems like stoves were kind of discovered to be a clean cooking an issue like in the 70s or 80s. And there was a lot of testing going on in a lab in a more affluent country. And then there was the youth in the field in a less affluent country. And there was a big disconnect. But luckily here at Burners On Lab, we spend a lot of time in the field meeting with people and trying to get, that human, that testing with people that are actually using the stove to understand needs. So a lot of things that come up are, you know, do people want legs on the stove or not? You know, sometimes it's just a matter, it is just a matter of color. Sometimes it's a matter of whether they like the handle this size or not would be why they buy one. You know, reasons that unless you're there and you spend significant time with people understanding, you'll know why they actually end up using it or not. Sometimes it's not for the reasons you think. Sometimes they're just heating up for bath water versus actually cooking, you know. So understanding the customer and changing to that, is an important part of what we do.
Kevin?
Yeah, thanks, Emilio. I'm an electrical engineer myself. Thanks for explaining how critical it is to match that engineering design process with the real end user. And sometimes we think of the end user as the company that's going to sell the product. No, the end user is the person who's got the stove in hand. Thank you for that. Hey, the question that comes to mind for me is, has Burn Design Lab taken on the challenge of calculating the sum of the environmental benefit that you're providing as a result of the work you're doing?
From what I've heard, we are beginning to work on that. And an important reason why, the reason why we're beginning it is going to be a bit of a process, because we, you know, the way the things that we design, and sometimes we give a design, we don't know how many people are actually buying it. You know, there's a lot of variables, so it's going to take us time. I know that we're working on it. And an important reason being because a lot of carbon credit funding is actually done through clean cook stoves, because if you take someone who's cooking on an open fire versus for a whole year versus someone cooking on a stove for a whole year, they have reduced that theoretical amount of carbon for that year. So the point being, we are hoping to learn how to get carbon funding, but you have to, yeah, an auditor comes in and it's a very important process and your numbers better be very accurate. So I know that we're working towards that, but it's going to take us some time.
All right. Yeah, one, I know I keep coming back with these things, but
no, please.
When I said I had been in Kenya back in 08, we were actually tent camping. And when you talked about heating water, it just reminded me they use charcoal for all of their cooking and heating of water. And every evening they would have these very unique looking things that they heated the water in the river water. But they were very unique in design. And I would assume it comes from somebody like you guys that figured out how to do that. But then the other thing they have are the cook stoves. And those, their cooks using that charcoal produced amazing meals. I mean, we're talking gourmet meals off of these charcoal stoves. They were amazing. So I would be pretty excited about what you guys are doing. And my other question is, are there any other products that you're working on or that you have in the downstream that you're thinking about?
Yeah, as of right now, really, we stay in the cook stove space. I think the products, quote unquote, if I were to distinguish them. So one is the more simpler, small kind of handheld charcoal or firewood stove. Like I mentioned in Ghana, it's a little harder to picture. It's about the size of a big oil drum. And that's how they roast shea nuts, is they would just put that over an open fire. Again, the problem being a lot of smoke, fuel inefficient. So in Ghana, we developed one. And so, you can picture the size of a big drum. And it's just same, more fuel efficient. The third, I would say, product and more kind of a concept is the manufacturing side. Like I said, a lot of organizations come to us and they roughly like their stove design. The problem is they're built with hammers and car leaf springs banging metal over an anvil, very, very artisanal, custom specific, and that's tough to scale. So we're learning how to find and customize machinery that can help them reach those higher production numbers more efficiently. And so that's kind of the third product or service. A lot of these are, especially because of the how electricity can be hard to be dependable. We're learning how to get manual machines, which we're learning there's not very many left in the world anymore. So this is kind of a unique problem where people still need these machines, but it's so specialized. So we're learning how to customize them for cutting sheet metal at this volume. So you run into very specific problems with that. And that's probably where our most innovation and engineering comes from, because there's not many other people working on this problem. So those are kind of, I would say, the three products that we're focused on.
Great. So Emilio, how does what you're doing translate into the industrial world, the industrialized world? I mean, are things that you're developing being applied in designs in Europe, United States, Asia? You know, what's that relationship?
I think the last thing could be what I just hit on there, which is the production side. Really, just it's, I can try, sheet metal comes in these giant rolls, and at a typical sheet metal factory, they're producing hundreds of thousands of cuts a day. You know, everything's electronic, very specialized. But if you're, let's say, a mid-level HVAC supplier, you're working with thin sheet metal, and you only need to make a couple of cuts a day, maybe you do them by hand, but there's not much between by hand and expensive automated machinery. But what we developed is a table shear with a custom back gauge that lets you set to different depths and make cuts, foot powered. So if you're running a small business in one of those areas, you probably have this problem, but maybe haven't spent the time to think about it. So that could be a technology that translates. Just because it's so, specialized. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Any chance one of those machines might be available in the Vashon tool library for our use here on the island?
Maybe we're, I mean, we're only across the street, so maybe we should bring that up. I know it took us some time. We, you know, we built it and we shipped it out. And we're seeing how it operates in the field, how it's going to handle. And then, we're hoping to make another one. Maybe another factory comes to us and we can make another one. Yeah.
So I misunderstood. You're actually building the machine that does the bending and the cutting.
I guess what I would say, so the cutting itself, mm-hmm. that machine we kind of purchase off the shelf.
Right.
What these, we call them a shear, imagine just a table cutter, but it's a meter wide. What they don't come with is a back gauge. So let's say you want to make a bunch of cuts at 500 millimeter. Yeah, something like that. You have to kind of mark it or cut it. Or the problem is the sheet metal is too thin, so it drops uh-huh. below the gauge that it comes with. So we had to make a custom table with measuring tapes and everything so you can set different gauge depth. Okay. And that's what those machines don't come with. Because typically, if you're cutting, again, if you're cutting sheet metal that thin, you're probably in a high-end expensive facility with automated equipment. So there's no one that's needing that market.
Yeah, so... this question sort of came from Kevin. Is there changes in country or state or legislation that you're advocating or that would help you do your job better around the world?
Yeah, no, we looked at that. Right now, there aren't any specific laws that come to mind. We just recommend, you know, people are informed and vote, and obviously recommend voting for legislation or representatives that are focused on improving the environment is what we would say.
Great. Yeah. Good. Thanks. So how can Islanders get involved? You know, what can Vashon Islanders do to become more of a part of Burn Design Labs?
Yeah, the first thing I would say, definitely check out our website, social media, on every platform for more information. And as far as really getting involved, you know, we actually do run quite a bit on volunteers. We have a couple engineers that are paid staff, but we also have a couple retired engineers, some who live on islands, some who live in Seattle, and they come to our production meetings and they help us develop this. So, you know, we don't have any specific roles right now, but what'll happen is people reach out to us and they say, hey, I have a background in machinery. I have a background in administrative work, engineering. What can I do? And if people come to us, we tend to find out, you know, what are their skills and how can that match what we're looking for? So we do run on volunteers and we always appreciate people just coming by.
Great. Well, this has been fascinating, Emilio. Anybody else? Any other questions for Emilio? If not, we'll move on. Emilio, please feel free to stay with us and join the conversation. Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, and the only thing I was going to say, Emilio, thank you. I know we reached out to a number of folks at Burn Design Lab, and you are a fantastic spokesperson for the organization. I appreciate the fact you could join us today.
Yes. Yeah, no, thank right. you so much.
Yep, thank you.
Great, thanks. So Election Day is 1 week from today. What are the predictions, guys? Blue wave, red wave, purple wave?
Well, great. I just, you know, the pollsters, obviously, for what they're worth, have tightened up a whole slug of these races. And the pendulum keeps swinging back and forth. They say that all the enthusiasm was there behind the Supreme Court opinion regarding abortion. That has waned somewhat. And now, of course, it's not of course, but it's inflation. As if the United States was the only place in the world where there's inflation, when in fact our inflation is considerably less than most countries, including major industrialized countries, which always just drives me crazy. You know, who's responsible? It's just a knee-jerk sort of reaction. The people who are in charge. If I'm not happy at home, let's get some change. That's what I'm most fearful of.
And a question for Emilio, since you are spending that time in Africa, are you seeing any indications of inflationary pressures there?
Yeah, so it kind of, I'm not the most educate on Paul, things like that. But I have traveled recently, and I can say everyone's experiencing inflation. As we were driving around, I was just looking at gas prices and realizing, wait, that's more than it was than the last time I was here. Everyone is facing it, and it's especially hard to see countries that can't handle that level experiencing it. So yeah, it's not just a problem here for sure.
Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, I'll say, Bruce, I sort of cringe at the predictions question. I totally understand it, and I've tried to put myself in that position in the past. I will say that in 2020, where we were tracking very, very closely the polling data and other factors that would hopefully give us some indication of the outcome, we found out that pollsters are oftentimes very wrong, number one. I actually did an analysis of the pollsters checking their record of how many races they called within like 2%. And that's like helpful because, wow, they got really accurate on some polls. But you also have to look at how many races they called where they were way off. And yeah, there were not too many pollsters that actually had a high incidence of accurate polling and a low incidence of inaccurate polling. So I think that's important for people to understand. I also think that I think the trends are important. Not that it'll predict the outcome, but I think it'll give us an insight into what might be going on in the electorate. One is the large proportion of women who have now been registering to vote. I think it's the voter turnout. And if the models and the voter preferences are aligned with the way they were 2 years ago, the early turnout numbers are typically progressives because of the emphasis of the last administration that, no, you should only vote on election day. That's, which is total. So can I say BS on the air? it's because I did. But typically that early vote is people who recognize that voting early and dropping off your ballot in a drop box, or in our case, in a mailbox, is really, there's no incident, a significant incident of fraud in any capacity. So those are some trends that I feel comfortable about. And there's some recent headlines that, hey, the progressives are making great advances right now. That's all based on polling and that polling. And like I say, it's kind of... hard to hang your head on.
Well, you just watch Steve Kornacki on MSNBC and you'll get an idea of how crazy the polling is. One of the things that I found interesting, though, I think it was in Georgia where they looked at the early voting and they were like four times what it was during the general, the presidential mm-hmm. election, which is astounding to me that in a midterm election that they would do that.
Yeah, great.
The pundits and the pollsters are suspect. I read an article, actually it was a printed article from one of the television news channels here in Seattle that talked about there were 17 cases of alleged fraud that were uncovered in King County that they're investigating, not proven. And the article ended off with... that's just less than 1% of the 1.7 million people who will be voting. Math is hard, but it's not that hard. 17 is 0.0001% of.
Not 1%.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, this whole fraud argument, when we were out doing our voting, get out the vote costume party thing, we did talk to a gentleman who brought up voter fraud. And I brought up the 62 or so court cases that only one of which found any incident of fraud. The reaction to that I got was, well, none of those actually went to court, you know. And I thought, wait a minute. Of all of the clamoring for voter fraud and it's all fake and blah, blah, blah that we heard, that they somehow never brought those cases to court. I'm sorry. So the whole voter fraud story continues to evolve in really kind of weird ways. I think we should recognize that our voting systems are by and large very, very safe, and participating is super important. Emilio, thanks also for helping to amplify that message.
Emilio, I mean, you grew up in California, you went to school in Texas, you live here now. You know, what are the differences that you see, you know, in terms of the political climate, you know, the messaging, whatever, in those three very different sort of locations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little hard for me to say because I was pretty young in California. I was definitely more a voter age in Texas, and then now being here at this age now, I'll be honest. I'm more of the generation where we call it doom scrolling. You just see things show up on your feed, and so I try to find a way to stay informed, but not to the point where, you know, you read it and it emotionally affects you. So I'll just say that I'm pleased with how I read the news here in Washington, and I don't know. It gives me more hope than when I get. What's going on in Texas.
I was gonna say, come on, he's in Texas and he is studying his butt off. If you want to know, is he going to pay any attention to that? I don't think so, you know. It at least I remember being in college, I was not real political. I was busy keeping my head down.
So Truman, you sent us an interesting sort of selection of your friends in Montana's views of the world. You know, what are they thinking, or what are you hearing from them about the election?
You know, I haven't really heard about the election. They kind of keep a low profile until I goad them, and I goad them occasionally with something, and then I get a bunch back. But I do it just to kind of see where they're at, you know. And I have not gotten a response on the election yet.
So we had an attack on Paul Pelosi just a few days ago. What's your read on that as a briefly? What do you guys see? Craig, let me throw that ball to you.
Yeah, it's another example of how speech, I think, can affect behavior, can put imprimatur on certain kinds of behavior, can allow it to a certain degree. People can come away and go, well, you know, something I would have considered now is something that seems to be almost authorized. The thing that bothers me as much as the actual attack is the response. The response I've heard from the right is one of these false equivalency responses that the Dems do it too. You did it with Justice Kavanaugh, and people went to his house. You know, that false equivalency thing just drives me crazy because it's not a false equivalency. There is significant difference between the language that is used on the right about attacking and hurting and shooting and whatnot that you just rarely see from the left. I'll leave it at that.
Well, and you know, but that sort of brings up the First Amendment kind of issue. I mean, should there be limits on free speech? And how do you define those limits?
There are limits on free speech. You can't slander people. You can't defame them. You can't yell fire in a crowded room. You can't incite individuals to violence.
You know, but these people who are coming up with all this cockamamie stuff about who this guy was or is, it turns out he may be an illegal immigrant from Canada. And I just read that recently. He came to the U.S. when he was like 16 or something and never went back, you know. But I thought that was interesting that they're making a big deal out of, he's an illegal alien. Well, that hardly has anything to do with anything, the fact that the guy's been here that long.
But, Kevin, how do you read this?
Well, I'm first of all, I'm happy we're having this discussion. Of course, people who are paying attention to the news, you've heard lots and lots and lots of commentary on this already. So, but I think it's really important. You know, it's no hidden agenda here. I'm the creator and leader of Indivisible Vashon. Have been that for 5 years. I associate with people who we're not happy with the values of the former administration, and their frustration would show. And I have heard people literally talk about becoming homicidal in reaction to what they're hearing. But I think it's really important that as we hear and we feel this, the emotional revulsion over this attack on Paul Pelosi, when we turn the table and think about our frustration and expressing that frustration in a similar way, we create the same revulsion in those who feel aligned with the person who attacked Paul Pelosi. So the bottom line is that political violence does not advance our agenda. There's a great history that I read about that in various political and social movements. And I don't recall the details and I don't recall the countries, but they charted the course of organizers who were able to stay away from political violence and their rate of success compared to those who were unable to stay away from political violence and their failure to achieve their objectives. So while we all are in a very position where a lot of frustration and angst and anger are all reasonable responses to some of the things we're hearing about today, I think it's just super important to realize that crossing that line does not advance our agenda. And it really, we lose the support. If we're trying to make change, crossing the violence line, we lose the will and the benefit of the people we're trying to reach out to. It's just, I think, really important to recognize that. So thanks for that opportunity.
If you look at, I think back of the movie Gandhi, and you look at the what he did and the way he approached his nonviolent approach was incredibly effective. You know, every time it was the most effective of everything.
Yeah, I think of the photograph of, I recall it as a young blonde woman, it would have been in the 60s, walking down a line of like guardsmen and putting daisies in the
rifle barrels.
The rifle barrels, yes.
Yeah, I think we can all see that, what you talked about with the protesters who were throwing paint on the Van Gogh, you know, in the art gallery, and not, you know, I'm a big believer in civil disobedience, but some things are not the greatest bits of advocacy. They have a tendency to turn people away more than they turn toward that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So we see the war in Ukraine. You know, the Russians have turned to sort of warring on the civilians of Ukraine, knocking out power grids, knocking out water systems. How should the United States react to that? Silence.
I want to turn loose the warthogs, the A-10 warthogs is what I want to do, but that's me.
Those are war crimes. Knocking out infrastructure, civilian infrastructure like that is definitely a war crime. I'm frustrated by this as well. These rules of engagement are so interesting and almost fictional, novelesque in a sense. We can do this, but you can't do that. And we can kill everybody on your side of the line, but you can't throw a missile over onto our side of the line. Obviously there it's nuanced, and you've got to be careful not to try to create a major World War III. But there's there's diplomacy, which I believe in, but there's also consequences that I believe in.
Yeah.
My hope is that military alliances create stability in this global connected world that we live in. I know that not everybody believes that, and there's cases where military alliances have moved us into conflict as opposed to away from conflict. So there's examples, I suspect, on either side. I think the examples we don't see are where military alliances have prevented us and have been a deterrent to engaging in physical violence, in warfare. And that's the part you don't see. So my hope is that we should continue to build the alliance. We should continue to support our allies and those countries that share our progressive and democratic values. And I think what the current administration is doing is exactly the right thing, to be supportive, but not stepping into the middle of the fight.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. And thank you, Emilio, for being here. And for Kevin, Truman, Craig, I'm Bruce Holman. See you next week on the next edition of the Brown Briefly.